It's a funny thing choosing sermon titles. Today's title, The Common Good of These Tender Days, comes from two different sources, actually, two different elements of today's service and message. The common good alludes to a goal that has been articulated in our 2014 General Assembly Study Action Issue, which I'll explain more about later. But the idea is that as Unitarian Universalists, this year and for the next several years, we will join to develop a vision of the common good that animates a movement towards sustainable well-being for all. It sounds good, doesn't it? Common good is not a new concept altogether, but reemerges as an important one. I'm using it today as a means to talk about what it is, what is good for the whole, as opposed to good for each individual one of us or a few of us. And these tender days pluralizes the words from the offertory we heard this morning, which is a hymn. Vision be my guide as I seek my way. Lead me into this tender day. Speak through me in all I do and say. The second verse, justice be my guide, then mercy be my guide. All days, all of our days of life are tender. And as I read the words to this translated Chinese folk song, I thought, surely always they have been for one reason or another. But what about the common good in these tender days that we are now living? What is it that is working against the common good? And how is it contributing to a time that feels somehow so filled with uncertainty, so precarious? The threat of ISIS, for example, climate change threatening life as we know it, the Ebola virus in Texas, no less. That's a small sampling of what keeps us engaged, keeps us experiencing the tenderness of this time. My somewhat thinly disguised goal, ultimately, is to support an inquiry into a phenomenon that is plaguing our world presently, the issue of escalating inequality. On the one hand, an economic issue, and on the other hand, so much bigger than that. It is the name of the study action issue I mentioned earlier. The ever-widening spread between the very few with enormous assets and thus enormous power, and the very many with reduced assets and thus less and less power should be a concern to all of us. The ripple effects are varied and innumerable. We've all watched the graphs and seen the pie charts. We've read the reports of how few people have control of such enormous wealth. You may be aware that we faced a similar phenomenon in this country in the early part of the 20th century, at which point Louis Brandeis quipped, "We can have democracy in this country, or we can have great wealth concentrated in the hands of a few, but we can't have both." So a small plug, I want to remind you that in fact the movie Inequality for All with Robert Reich will be shown tonight in the parish hall at 7 o'clock. And it is a fantastic way to begin to understand what's going on in our global economy and why I so strongly encourage you to come watch it and find out. But for today, at least for this morning, I want to peel back the layers a bit, go back further in our collective Western culture, in the psyche that unites us all. I want us to think about what might have predisposed us to this sort of mess in the hopes that if we can unravel some of that, we might have a better chance to see the picture writ large and discern a way to address it at the root. We've talked a little bit over the last few weeks about some of the cultural assumptions in our largely Protestant beginnings and about how we as Unitarian Universalists have stepped away from some of those. Belief in original sin, for example. Regardless of our perspectives on Adam and Eve's journey towards self-awareness, which is what resulted in the concept of original sin. And you'll remember their journey included coming to awareness of their differences for the first time and being made self-conscious of them. I wonder how many of you remember the result of their misbehavior in terms of their livelihoods. Do you remember that when they were banished from the Garden of Eden, they were told that from now on, life would be difficult. The woman would bring forth children in pain. And I wondered if Eve might have asked, "What are children?" And the man was destined to toil the earth. "Thorns and thistles it shall bring forth to you, and you shall eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your face you shall eat bread until you return to the ground." In other words, Adam and Eve had to go to work. They had to labor, both in childhood and the field, no longer the cushy, provided-for existence of equality and gentle living among the fruits of God's labor, but exile to a place of burden and brutality, of scratched-out existence till dust claimed them again. I want to suggest that this story, this ethic, is woven so finely into the fabric of our culture, so pervasively, that we are hardly aware of it. This culture has told us over and over again that we are laborers because those two made a bad choice. And somewhere deep in the recesses of our brains, I think we remember that, if only in our perspective on what it means to labor. Remember Lincoln's words this morning in our responsive reading? He reminds us that labor is the common burden of our race. And by that he means human race. Labor is the common burden of the human race. We are made to work, and it is, at its core, a burden, at least within this theology. Sadly, so sadly, it casts work in such a negative light. Work, by definition, is not fulfilling or soul-satisfying. It's what we have to do since we got kicked out of Eden. Finding our bliss and making money at it is a fairly new construct. Traditionally, culturally, work is not especially creative or an expression of curiosity. It's not rewarding or joy-filled, if even as a means to an end. It is what we do because a mistake was made, so now we have to feed ourselves, like Charlotte, if you recall, and so it is our burden. And Lincoln reminds us, the curse, therefore, the curse of the human race is the effort of some to shift their share onto the shoulders of others, because, of course, who would want to work? Lincoln suggests, it is a curse, because it pits us one against the other, focusing not on how we could get together in the interests of all, but in the self-interest of work avoidance. "As I would not be a slave," he said, "so I would not be a master." But this is evolved thinking. This is Lincoln reminding us that those who deny freedom to others deserve it not for themselves and cannot long retain it, he says. These were the tender arenas of his day, with the long ingrained perspective on labor and the temptations it engenders to avoid it. And then time goes by, another 100 or more years, and the profile of labor shifts. No longer the agrarian forms of centuries past, but the gradual industrializing of product development. Yet work still is our burden, even if shortened to a 40-hour week. And in this new environment, thinkers, designers, managers, administrators, entrepreneurs take on more valued positions, so that labor per se is not labor as we have known it, as direct resource for sustenance. The character of how we define labor continues to change, and it becomes valued differently as well. So the shifting of the burden onto the shoulders of others takes on a new quality too. Those who actually labor become more closely identified as the carriers of Adam and Eve's blunder, perhaps. Laborers are somewhat lesser, closer to the dust to which we shall all return, possibly. And a new aspiration evolves to be one of the non-laborers, to have the resources to project oneself and one's children out of the caste of workers, because work, after all, is soulless and hard. Time spirals forward some more. Markets change, economies grow and evolve, and labor is cheaper elsewhere in the world and devalued even further, though how we have forgotten its true measure is stunning, since creating things is what makes the world turn as it does. Still, the minds that create become increasingly separated from the actual arenas of creation. So now, if you have a good idea and you can sell it, you can likely live on the proceeds as they get invisibly invested in something else, which is produced who knows where, and your assets grow of their own accord. And so then you don't have to work anymore because your money works for you. And Adam might have said, "Eve, isn't this amazing? Let's chill." And sadly, we needn't actually see the way we are denying freedoms to others by this disparity of accumulation, since we can't actually see much of any of it, unless we look. It is not my intention this morning to point fingers at any of us as individuals or cast aspersions on financial success, but to encourage us to consider the big picture, the system in which we live that has become increasingly imbalanced. This is not casual wealth we're talking about. This is a whole new level of extreme that is challenging the core of our social structures, and it's not a good long-term plan for us. I wonder why images of the good life are always painted in colors of affluence and ease. Maybe Eden was just that great. How would we feel differently if we imagined, if we had ingrained images of the common good life, where everybody does a good day's work together and then everybody gets to rest? Some of you may know that our oldest daughter got married recently, and it was really fun. It was great. My new son-in-law built a website for the wedding, which he called "Brian is the Luckiest Guy Ever." He's right, of course. And his comparative declarative started a trend of hyperbole for the entire event. This is the best weekend ever. This is the greatest beer in the world. This is the happiest wedding I've ever been to. So aside from the fact that all those things were true, it got me wondering about the implication of EST, est, as in best or luckiest or happiest or richest. They're not, by definition, bad aspirations, although the competitive edge might suggest something a little needy. But it matters who the aspiration is intended for, doesn't it? Think of all the reality TV shows we have on now. I had to look this up. The Biggest Loser, The Deadliest Catch, MXC, Most Extreme Elimination Challenge, Million Dollar Listing, Keeping Up with the Kardashians. Okay, these may not be on your top 10 list, but they do indicate a predisposition of our present culture to be highly competitive for the individual success. This is, after all, what our country was based on. I wonder how we think a show about the best co-housing community in the world would do. Not like Real World. You know, remember Real World? They were all like frantic and crazy people. This would be about ordinary people working for the common good in their living choices, sharing resources. My husband was reminding me a couple weeks ago that in the Netherlands, I guess they watch slow TV. So they just sit and watch water boil or, you know, I don't know. I think our co-housing show would be a step above that. We have escalated success in this culture to be defined by that which is the greatest distance from the labor that God made Adam and Eve responsible for. Because, after all, who would want to do that? I want to get back to the study action issue on escalating equality for a minute. For those of you who are unfamiliar with the process, there is a vote every year at General Assembly, which is our annual gathering of Unitarian Universalists. A number of proposals are offered every year as contemporary concerns that would benefit from study and attention. So the delegates have a chance to consider their options and then vote for one particular issue to focus on for a period of years. And this year's issue has the stated goal that I mentioned earlier, to join together to develop a vision of the common good that animates a movement towards sustainable well-being for all, to reduce demands on the Earth's resources, and to nourish the soul by sharing life's essentials. I suspect this is nothing less than a culture change, a broad and sweeping need to shift our attention away from individual success towards common value, based on how our hearts respond to the shared and collective good. It requires us to reframe our ideas about the value of work as burden and to think about how it might be a part of a shared human endeavor that sustains us all, as opposed to something we long to avoid or offload onto someone else. Now, this may seem like a big chunk of work for a relatively small group of folks, but I agree with economist Peter Drucker's suggestion that the best way to predict the future is to create it. These are the tender days that need a different vision for our future. And I'm hoping we can start that here. I'll see you tonight at 7 o'clock, and I'll bring the popcorn. Amen.